but my name is Simpson Garfinkel, and I put together this panel. We will be talking about digital money and what sort of regulatory aspects might be required for these new electronic coins. Electronic money, threat to law enforcement, privacy, freedom, or all three? Law enforcement agencies and federal government are downright fearful of anonymous electronic payment systems. Such systems, they argue, will make it impossible for criminals to launder money, hide ill-gotten gains, and contract for illegal payments and services as never before. What kind of privacy is necessary to safeguard transactions? How can the purchase of data be misused? How could law enforcement prevent a system for anonymous micropayments from being manipulated to make large-scale anonymous payments? If a payment organization creates an anonymous encrypted digital cash system, how will the government regulate it? This panel aims to set the ground rules for the digital money discussions that are expected to be forthcoming in the following years. Our first speaker will be David Chong. We also have Mr. Stan Morris, Kuika Davio, and Raphael Hirschfeld. Dr. David Chong, Managing Director of DigiCash, is widely regarded as the inventor of the concept of anonymous digital cash. Chong received his PhD in computer science from the University of California at Berkeley, then taught at New York University Graduate School of Business Administration and at the University of California, and headed the cryptography group at CWI, the Dutch nationally funded center for research in mathematics and computer science, before taking his current position. He has published over 45 original technical articles on cryptography and also founded the International Association for Cryptologic Research. And each speaker will have 10 minutes, and then we'll get on with the scenarios. Dr. Chong? I'll give you a two-minute warning.
Thank you, Simpson. Let me see if I can... I'm not sure I know how to operate this gadget here. Oh, there we go.
Can you switch the video to the overhead?
Well, anyway, in any case, it's a great pleasure to be here, and Simpson has asked me to say a little bit about how I came to the idea of electronic money and my motivation in particular. And I'd just like to use the opportunity that he's provided me there to say just a couple things which I find to be extremely important, and I hope you'll take them in the spirit with which I mean them, and I realize that I founded the International Association for Cryptologic Research at a time when it seemed the government was going to outlaw such organizations and conferences of that type. And since then, I haven't really felt that anything needed any real serious attention out there, honestly, until very recently. I've been hearing a few reports from some of my friends. It seems like there may be a very significant coup underway in the area of regulation of cryptography, and it's causing me a great deal of concern, and I think it would be unfortunate if this conference were to take place and people weren't aware of this. So I hope you'll, if you're really concerned about this kind of thing, you'll look around and see what's happening in the area of international policy in this area. It seems to be a very, very strange turn of events just in the last few weeks. Furthermore, I really do love these conferences, and I have attended almost every one of them. And I've even been on the program committee this year. And I think that an organization like this is really important. I think it could do a lot more between these conferences. And what I'd like to see perhaps a little more democratic structure, a little more democracy in the choice of the chairman and the program committees and that sort of thing. And I think that's something that I'd like to draw your attention to. I think we could be doing a lot more in between the conferences electronically and so on. Okay, maybe those are my unrelated comments. Now I'd like to talk about electronic cash. And what I'd like to tell you about is how it works, because I think that's really important in order to understand the policy implications. And the essential idea of electronic cash is that it is a bearer instrument. There are only fundamentally two types of payment systems: account-based, where you send a message to your bank saying, please move money from my account to someone else's account, and bearer instruments, where, like paper money and coins, you have the money and you can hand it to someone else. Now, electronic cash is a digital bearer instrument. And so the way you obtain it is from your bank, just like when you visit an ATM machine. And you withdraw it and you download it into your workstation over the internet in the eCash form, which is, as you may know, live on the internet today from a number of banks. Once it's there, you can later go and spend it from your hard disk to whoever you wish to pay, and what they will do is send that money into the bank, and when the bank says that's good money, those bits haven't been spent previously, then they will send you the goods. Now, the system, as I've just shown it, doesn't really protect people's privacy. What you need is something more sophisticated in the withdrawal process, in the way you obtain the cash. So instead of just letting the bank make up the serial numbers at random or however and sell them to you, which would let the bank trace your payments because it would be able to recognize your money when you spend it, what we can do is use the so-called blind signature technique, which is shown here. And if, I realize that many of you are not technologists, but I think it's important to try to understand how this works, because a lot of the policy implications flow from this. Now, the way it's done is that the workstation creates the serial number, or you can think of it as the blank coin, the blank digital coin, at random. And then it hides that coin, that blank, in an envelope. Now, that's really just an encryption using a secret key that's known to your workstation. And the coin is just a random serial number, in fact. And so what's sent to the automatic teller machine in cyberspace is an envelope that contains the blank coin. And when, let's say, a dollar is withdrawn from your checking account, the bank makes a validating signature mark on the outside of the envelope. Now, that is like, that's in fact an RSA digital signature or the equivalent. But you can think of it as a stamp that penetrates right through the whole envelope and coin assembly. And so that when the envelope is returned, your software can decrypt the envelope, can remove the envelope, because it had the secret key which was used to form that envelope initially. And the result is the blank coin that your software created, but now it bears the validating signature that only the bank could issue. And so now you have digital coin, which you can store on your hard disk and you can later use in payment. When you provide it to a retailer or a merchant, they will perhaps verify that it's really issued by the bank, because they can check that signature. They'll send it on to the bank, and the bank will look at it and say, yes, we really issued this coin, and according to our database, we have not yet received a coin with this serial number. So we'll add the serial number to the database, and we'll send an acknowledgement back to the retailer saying it's good, and the retailer will then supply the goods or services. However, so the bank does not know which person withdrew that coin, because all of the coins are hidden in envelopes during the withdrawal process. So that means that when you go to buy a pack of gum or whatever with digital cash, you are not forced to identify yourself in order to make that payment, just like today with cash. And however, that's the kind of privacy that we expect with paper money. However, thank you. However, what you can do is you can allow that payment to be traced if you wish to. So unlike with cash, where you can't necessarily prove who received your funds, okay, with electronic cash as we've implemented it, and as we envision it being implemented in the future, the person who made the payment is always in a position to show who the recipient was by simply revealing the serial number on the coin. Go to the bank, and the bank can say, yes, that money was really deposited to this account. Now, that has some very important implications, because the major criminal uses of a payment system are black markets, extortion, and bribery. And in all of those situations, the recipient of the funds, you know, the person who receives it would not accept the check today. What kidnapper would take a check in payment, right? So if they know that you can always trace them, even if they don't cooperate, because you know the serial numbers and you can go to the bank and see which account it was deposited to, then it's unsuitable for that type of payment. And the other serious criminal use of payment systems is related to money laundering and tax evasion. Now, this same traceability feature, with one-way privacy, we call it, also addresses that issue. In fact, if I could hand someone in this room a bag with a lot of paper money in it, and no one else would have to know about that. But with eCash, when I send it to someone, they have to deposit it immediately, because if they don't, I might deposit it myself in advance, and I would be the recipient. I would get the money. So what it means is that the total inflow, the total amount of revenue that each person receives, is known to their financial institution. And that's the sort of thing that prevents the use of this medium for money laundering and tax evasion. Of course, it's intended primarily for low-value payments. Now, eCash is not limited to, let me just in summary point out that it's not limited to internet payments, which are live now, but it can also be used in chip cards and in electronic wallets and so forth. As you'll hear about, we have made systems for road tolling, highway speed, and a whole variety of applications.
Thank you very much, Dr.
Okay.
Chan.
Thank you.
I hesitate to point out that we're trying to make these initial talks very quick so that we can have some discussion. Next, we're going to have Raphael Hirschfeld, who comes from the European Union community, and he's involved in the CAFE project. Raphael Hirschfeld has worked with CWI, the Dutch National Research Laboratory for Mathematics and Computer Science, for the past 3 years, serving as an interim leader of cryptography group and the technical director of the CAFE project. Before joining CWI, he did graduate work on electronic money at MIT, and he's going to speak for about 5 minutes, showing us something that's actually in use.
Okay, thank you very much, Simpson. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here today to discuss some of the privacy aspects of electronic money. As Simpson mentioned, I've been working at CWI for the past 3 years as technical director of the CAFE project. The CAFE project is a European consortium which has developed a very general access for conditional access in general, and in particular is demonstrating a electronic purse system in the headquarters, in the premises of the European Union in Brussels. And I brought with me some of the actual devices we have actually running in Brussels. These are the actual cards. This is a little infrared wallet, which is used for making payments at a distance. And I invite anybody. Anybody who is interested in learning more about the project to come to the BOF session this evening, where I'll give a more detailed explanation of what the project is about, et cetera. For this panel, I think it makes more sense to be to take a sort of broader perspective. Just one thing I'd like to mention, this CAFE project is the same project that George Medikides mentioned yesterday in his opening address to the conference. Anyway, more broadly about electronic money, the computerization of consumer payments has really offered unprecedented convenience and flexibility, et cetera. But at the same time, it's sort of an unprecedented danger against the privacy of personal financial transactions. Already with credit cards, profiles of spending habits are collected and sold, or can be anyway. And if when you actually bring this, extend this down using an electronic purse system to small value payments, which are normally handled by cash, this only exacerbates the problem. Now, this threat against personal privacy can be largely circumvented, in fact, entirely circumvented, using the techniques that are pioneered by our previous speaker, Dr. Chaum, that is, blind signatures, untraceable electronic money, also known as electronic cash. Now, some might argue that digital cash is really a technological solution to a more social problem. And to that, I can only reply that I agree. But that's precisely what's important about electronic cash. Many people have argued that because in order to get the convenience offered by electronic payments, et cetera, in order to get the security in such a system, you have to give up your privacy because that's the only way you can base the security. Electronic cash gives an example of a secure system which does not require you to give up your privacy. And as a result, it offers untraceability as a true choice. And this moves this moves the debate about privacy from the technological arena into the social arena where it really more properly belongs. And the decision can then be made by the market or by public policy, et cetera. Anyway, it's not clear to me, by the way, it may be clear to some of you, but it's not clear to me how that would be decided. I think that people are justifiably outraged when they find out that information about their payments have been collected and sold without their knowledge or consent. But on the other hand, I've observed that people are willing to sell their privacy for a song. Basically, if you give them a 1% rebate or a prize every now and then, they're perfectly happy to tell Safeway what they ate for breakfast. So, but at least electronic cash technology provides the option for untraceable payments. And let me just say why I think the Privacy Act advocate should use untraceable electronic money. It's basically the same reason that I think that they should use encryption on messages, even innocuous messages. It's because if people use these techniques only for sensitive transactions, then their very use becomes suspect and the user becomes the target of scrutiny. And it's only when these techniques are used routinely and ubiquitously that you can create the environment in which personal privacy is the norm. Anyway, Simpson has made up some scenarios which we're going to discuss in this session, and they raise some common concerns about electronic money. There are a lot of people who have fears about how it could be misused, et cetera. I think that all three of these scenarios really raise concerns that are based on misconceptions of how untraceability in electronic payments work, and I hope that will become clear from the discussion. Just one final point before I turn this over. I'd like to conclude by mentioning one of my own areas of interest in electronic money and a problem that I'm working on, and that is that in the last year or two, there's really been an explosion in the number of, on the one hand, internet payment mechanisms, mechanisms for making payments on via the World Wide Web, over the internet, et cetera, and on the other hand, electronic purse systems in various different countries, mostly in Europe, but also elsewhere. But there's been very little effort to unify these two worlds. Now, CAFE is actually a step in that direction, but it's not enough. And I envision the world not so far off in which you could receive electronic money via email, load it into your smart card, one of these, and take it down to the store and use it to buy a quart of milk or a pack of condoms or whatever, and no busybody would be the wiser. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think it's important to note that the kind of anonymous cash that we've been talking about so far is only one way to do electronic money. You could have a system that's completely anonymous and untraceable, and you could have a system that's completely traceable. Our next speaker, Stan Morris, is involved with tracing of money. He's director of FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. Mr. Morris heads the federal agency that is devoted to detecting financial crimes. FinCEN employs a sophisticated set of financial surveillance techniques, including the monitoring of wire transfers, reporting by banks of suspicious deposits and withdrawals, mandatory reporting of large cash transactions, and the sophisticated use of computers and models to detect patterns of illegal use. And Mr. Morris has a PowerPoint presentation. Maybe it's a director presentation.
I was going to say that sounds like an advertisement for Microsoft, and actually this is Macromedia. I'd like to make one brief observation before I begin here. I've been here this morning and this afternoon, and with all the government bashing going on, I had a fear that I'd accidentally walked into a Pat Buchanan rally or something. I approach this panel with some trepidation. What I'd like to do very, very quickly and half the time that I thought I had is to basically do what it says on the side of the National Archives in Washington, which is reflect on the fact that the past is indeed a prologue. We are concerned, obviously, all of us as citizens, about the need to balance, and the balance that exists between the reality that security and our, in fact, constitutional guarantees demand privacy and secrecy and fashion, as does criminal enterprise. Why do we care in the Department of the Treasury? We go back some 60 years, and I make a quick observation about Al Capone. Al Capone was, in fact, a murderer. He ran extortion. He ran the mob in Chicago and actually around this country, bootlegging and the like. He went and spent the rest of his life on the rock in Alcatraz, not for any of that because of tax, but because he avoided taxes. The money got him in trouble. So in the 1950s, Meyer Lansky came in to help the mob set itself up, and it became a very important aspect because what he decided to do was to figure out ways to avoid the problems that Big Al had. And he created, in fact, gave some money to Bugsy Siegel. He created Las Vegas. We created offshore banking centers in such places as Cuba. In the 1970s, you all remember the scene in Among the President's Men in which Bob Woodward was talking to Deep Throat, trying to figure out what, in fact, is going on in Watergate. And Deep Throat tells him, follow the money. And we have some 60 years here of the importance of following the money. We care, and I think this is very important for the policy discussions to come up. These are not two-bit crooks that we're talking about today. Organized crime cannot be organized, and it cannot develop power unless, in fact, it's successful in laundering its money. If, in fact, it is successful today, they must go through financial institutions in one fashion or another. And we see banks around the world, Russia, Colombia, Italy, et cetera, polluted, basically, by the interaction with organized crime. Why do we care about that? Because all over the world today, we have fragile, brand-new democracies and new efforts at free enterprise, all of which, in almost every country in the world, in part, are threatened by organized crime. I would opine that perhaps the single biggest problem we'll face in the 21st century is not state-based, the realities of state-based destruction, essentially, of economies and governments, but in fact, the power of organized criminals. Very quickly, how did we get to where we are? In 1970, people were bringing satchels of cash in. Cash was the modus operandi. The Congress responded with legislation called the Bank Secrecy Act. That's an act that my agency, Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, administers. The constitutionality of that was raised. Do we have a right? Does the government have a right to know about large amounts of cash that you bring in to institutions, either financial institutions or non-bank financial institutions? In a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court determined yes. Nevertheless, the banks did not play. until major efforts were made, in part by the governor of this state, when he was the U.S. attorney, when he took a number of executives from the Bank of Boston here for failing to comply with the laws. And such compliance basically began to develop a program. What happens next? Well, as soon as we become successful in one area, the bad guys move to another, non-bank financial institutions, whether we're talking here about casinos or check cashers or money transmitters or broker-dealers or whatever. So the Congress gave us authority to deal with that. Similarly, we began moving beyond cash, and the Congress has given us authority to deal with the movement beyond cash into monitoring wire systems and the like. And that brings us to today. New cyber payment systems are, in fact, coming on board. What does that mean? The short answer is we don't know. And indeed, we are working very carefully to try to understand what the implications might, in fact, mean. Let me just very quickly tell you what it is, the problem that we are trying to deal with. In the past, cash was anonymous. We made it not anonymous, at least a large parts of it not anonymous. You cannot very successfully anymore bring large amounts of drug money or extortion money into your bank. We've created new impediments to that. We have eliminated the anonymity of cash in large amounts. New cyber payment systems, of course, give a new strength to organized crime because we can put it all on a microchip. The cards that you saw in Cafe could have a few dollars on them, but there's nothing in the technology that can have millions of dollars on them. What's the other element? Governments have had abilities to try to deal with these problems, but the financial institutions have been where we have interacted in the past. All monies have had to, in one fashion or another, go through them. The new systems, as you saw with the card here, don't require that. They can be, in fact, face-to-face. Governments have tried to deal with these things largely in the new technologies. Governments and nation states are irrelevant. That's the reality that we in the Treasury Department face. Thank you, Pat. The response has to be, it seems to us, very, very carefully examined. But we do not have answers to this problem. We are not rushing to solutions. We have a number of tests going on. There are regulatory, there are enforcement approaches. There are also clearly major competitive issues around the world, not just in the U.S., that we have to pay attention to. And together we have to come up, I believe, as a society and as a set of societies in managing risk, which is what this is really all about. The efforts that we have made to date, and in the conclusion, David and a number of others were with us in New York at a colloquium that we set up. The purpose simply trying to bridge the communication barrier, almost a course in cultural anthropology, because cops and lawyers and bankers and new entrepreneurs in this area speak totally different languages. We need to bridge those so that there's some common understanding of what, in fact, the broad interests of our citizens are. Clearly, this cannot be dealt with domestically. As I said, the nation state, as it deals with financial services, is increasingly irrelevant. And we've been pushing in other forums to try to establish broad standards, at least of understanding, because I believe that Europe will be ahead of us in this area. And I think perhaps even some, but presumably previously called developing nations, may in fact move and skip decades of what we have done in this country. We have to work with the industry. Now, there is no question that there is no way that the government can, in fact, address these problems without a very, very close cooperative relationship with the new sectors. Secretary Rubin has established an e-money council. We are keenly interested in the Treasury Department about these new technologies because we are going to be users. 20% of the United States population is unbanked. We send them checks in the mail, a mindless way to operate for the poor, getting welfare checks and the like. Wouldn't it be better to give them one of those cards, make sure they don't have to pay an extortionate rate at a check cashier and the like? We believe that. And there are real opportunities But there are also opportunities for both the good guys and the bad guys. So in conclusion, we have to come up with ways to assess the vulnerabilities here in sensible, careful, contrived ways, not through rushing to regulation, but I think in a common understanding of a common problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Morris. I was wondering, what was the y-axis on your graph? The x-axis was time. Which? The y-axis is
the what? That's geometric. It was intended to be a geometric line of change in.
Our last speaker is Kawika Dagpio, federal representative for the American Bankers Association. Mr. Dago is ABA's representative to the federal government. His areas of expertise include banking operations, retail banking, and risk management. And he can tell you more.
Thank you. I just wanted to make it clear that I'm not here representing the ABA or bank members' views on these issues because, as a matter of fact, nobody can agree on the direction that all of this should go. So I'm speaking basically about general views that banks have about risk management and why banks, for example, care about whether information has to flow or not. The question probably most of you are asking is, why does information have to flow along with the value or the representation of value that's going along between you as an individual and somebody that you're buying something from? Well, banks are intermediaries in these processes. And what we do is we help people manage risk that they otherwise can't manage for themselves. Managing risk requires moving information or having information. The strategy that banks take to defend ourselves, no bank cares, for example, what kind of toothpaste you buy. We don't have access to that information. We can't use it. We can't store it. And there's really no reason to collect it. What we do care about is whether purchases that are being made represent real transactions that our customer initiated or whether they might be fraudulent transactions. We have a number of reasons why we're obligated to move information and to make it available under certain conditions. We're the watchdogs of the payment system. We have a moral obligation to make sure that enough information is available to all the participants in the payment system to defend themselves against people who would be shifting risk onto others. We have self-interest. Our members want to make sure, and all participants want to make sure, that people are not able to directly shift risk onto them. In many of these payment systems, there's a possibility for direct losses. Somebody may, for example, crack the code and create fraudulent currency that would cause the failure of a non-bank or a bank financial institution. In addition, there are relationships between merchants, banks, clearing houses, and customers that can't be captured by the most complex charts that you can think of. We call those kinds of risks systemic risks, and we call an additional layer of problem that we face contagion. If one system fails, regardless of whether it is related to others, regardless of whether the technology is even remotely similar, consumers may rush from all of those systems, causing runs and failures. That is unjustified, but you don't hear about failures of thrifts usually. You hear about failures of banks, even though the institutions that failed didn't have bank charters. Some of the other reasons why we move information are government requirements. For example, Regulation E is probably the most prominent reason why we move information. Regulation E gives consumers certain protections, and it gives them certain obligations. And it gives banks obligations as well. Regulation E, which governs electronic funds transfers, and Regulation Z, which governs credit card transactions, limit the risk of the consumers face from unauthorized transactions to a limited amount, usually about $50, even if they're grossly negligent. That creates some unusual problems for risk management for banks because there's no incentive on the part of the people who are holding access devices to maintain them securely. Regulation E also requires us to give customers information. Today, in the old world, we're required to give people paper receipts, paper disclosures, and paper statements. That gives customers the ability to determine whether their resources were used appropriately. The Federal Reserve has issued a proposal that many of you will be interested in probably commenting on, which takes stored value card systems out of those requirements. Now, depending on what kind of system you're looking at, the bank would no longer, under Regulation E, be required in the CAFE example or a card-based version of Dr. Chum's applications to give people liability protections. They may not have to give anyone disclosures of any kind. A non-bank financial institution is in a similar situation. No receipts, going to a vending machine, you know, really doesn't require rationally that somebody be given a receipt. But the question is whether it's a reasonable trade-off to give up the protections that people have in addition for in return for some privacy and confidentiality. And I guess in defense of the way that banks do things, I would have to argue that most people don't have a terrific concern that somebody is reading their checks individually. It can't be done. But technology gives, as we move towards electronic payments, gives people the opportunity to use that information. But technology, like the technology that Dr. Thomas has worked on and other approaches that Ernie Raquel and Peter Gemmel have worked on and other types of conditional privacy, give us and you the opportunity to give you additional protections against other people who shouldn't have access to any of the information about what you're doing. Now, because of our government obligations, including our bank secrecy compliance requirements, and because of concerns on the part of tax officials and their hooks in us, we are obligated to make sure that under specific circumstances, when due process has been followed, that we have to give certain information about people's transactions and make that available to the government. We don't permit fishing expeditions, and we don't permit our own people to search for information on their own. The technology that's out there, enhancements to Dr. Chum's pioneering work, can make the technology serve everyone's interests so that consumers wouldn't have to worry about fraud, that they wouldn't have to worry that that the system would fail them, that they wouldn't have to worry that their information is being sold for inappropriate purposes. And banks wouldn't have to worry about fraud. Those are things. The last issue that I'd like to raise is to ask perhaps for your help. There are several different types of systems out there, some are more secure and some are less secure. And the banking industry is looking at them. What we're looking for is additional solutions to those that the people are presented, because as far as most of our people have determined, we haven't found an ideal solution yet. The government has said that they're not interested in regulating the development of this technology, and we're glad. But pretty clearly, the banking industry and non-banks are operating under a regulatory structure which gives the government an interest and a hold over people who are deploying these systems. Banks can't move their operations offshore and work from Cuba. We're going to have to follow the laws of the land. Now, the question is whether we're going to use payment systems that circulate or payment systems that clear through a clearinghouse, and what kinds of information are going to be available to the people who handle those transactions under differing conditions. Now, it's arguable that a bank has a right to determine whether somebody spent the same coin 1,000 times. It is also possible for for a bank to claim that they should know, for example, where the money that disappeared out of their electronic vault went if somebody hacked their way into the system. So there's a number of reasons why we might ask for more than people think that we deserve. But we ask you to consider our interests and understand that if we agree on a solution that meets everyone's needs, that the government has conditional access, that the banks have conditional access, and that people have unconditional protection, that we can deploy a system that everyone will be able to use with comfort. And if we deploy it on the micropayments level, then everyone who cares to create content will have new opportunities, and everyone who cares to buy things will have additional protections, and no one loses. So if you have brilliant ideas, raise them with us, and there's an opportunity to make huge amounts of money like Dr. Tom's going to.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call this idea of conditional anonymity Clipper Cash. It's interesting that I used to have a checking account with a major stockbroking company, and they didn't return the checks to me. Instead, they returned an itemized statement of the amount of each check and the payee. And this was all kept in a computer, so they kind of were reading every check I wrote. We now are going to have some things to talk about. We have three people who've had interesting situations with digital cash. And the first one is coming up right now. Oh, these are hypothetical situations. David Chom, Dr. Chom is going to explain why they can't happen.
Hi, my name is Linda Peterson. Not really, but I'm 70 years old and penniless. 2 years ago, I opened one of those digital cash accounts at a local bank, and the manager told me that it would be safe, secure, and private. And that privacy was real important to me because I was sick and tired of getting calls during dinner from those damn people trying to sell me things. Well, I canceled my credit cards, arranged for my Social Security checks to be deposited directly into my BitCash account, and the calls finally stopped coming. And I discovered that using BitCash was easier than anything I had ever dreamed. I could buy my groceries, pay my rent, my electric bills, and even better, I could do it all over the phone. That was great last winter, especially when I broke my hip and couldn't leave the house for a month. Then one day, my BitCard stopped working. My PC said that there was no money left in the account. How could that be, I thought. There must be some kind of mistake. I went to the bank, and the manager that I spoke with had moved to a new job. His replacement told me that all of my money had been withdrawn in a series of $100 transactions over the past month. Since the system was anonymous and untraceable, there was no way to find out who had taken the money. And since it had all been done with my secret key, they said I had no way to contest the transfer. My key, they said, was better than my signature. That new manager even hinted that I might have taken the money out myself. They said that somebody had tried to do the very same thing a month ago, and that person was now awaiting a trial for filing a false police report. How can I get my money back?
Dr. Chom, why can't this happen?
Well, actually, I think it couldn't happen for a couple of reasons. First of all, because it's with eCash, say, for instance, you're continually updated on the balance in your account. So if something were to go wrong, I mean, you would obviously know it much more quickly than today with ATM cards, for instance, where you'd only find out at the end of the month. But I think more fundamentally it's important to notice that you would have the same recourse with eCash as you would have with any other kind of payment system, or probably better than with ATM cards, because as being the legitimate account holder, there is a secret seed number which you write down when you open the account initially, which is sort of created at random by your computer with your cooperation. And that number allows the serial numbers of the digital coins to be reconstructed at any time in the future, which for one thing, provides you recoverability in case your computer crashes or what have you, but for another, allows all of your payments to be traced by you, even if, no matter what happens. And so that would suggest that someone could find out where the person who has stolen her money was spending it, and might even be able to capture that person if they were.
We should point out that with ATM cards today, there are video cameras taking pictures when you take out that money. And with checks, there are signatures, and people have had bad checks passed. And normally checks are deposited in another account, and you can get the money back from the other account. But you have just explained how to steal money from somebody who has an eCash account. You first have to booby trap their computer and get that seed. Does anybody else?
The issue with the scenario doesn't seem to me to make any difference whether this is eCash or credit cards or anything else, because the operative issue in the first paragraph is that this is interaction with her local bank. And I've seen nothing that would suggest to me that the banking supervisory protections, et cetera, that exist for already to protect the consumer would change. So I don't know that the digital cash part of the scenario is very relevant.
I completely agree with that. Plus, I'd like to point out that one of the reasons it's thought to be more dangerous with this electronic cash is because of the anonymity feature. But the anonymity really provides anonymity during payment. Always during a withdrawal from your account, there's full authentication that you're actually talking to the correct person.
I'd like to add just kind of a counter. Because of the general perception of how these systems work, misunderstood systems, the government is looking at whether it is necessary to give people protections when most people think that getting enough, having the information to prove that the money was inappropriately used or stolen from somebody. If most people believe that there isn't enough information moving in order to prove that the money was stolen, then it's unlikely that consumers are going to have access to protections against against unauthorized transactions, and that's what the government is looking at. They view it as a balance between privacy and protection, and consumer protections.
Yeah, it's possible that this might be in some future when those regulations have been repealed, and you have a choice. You can have the account that gives you privacy and no security, or you can have less privacy and security.
Well, in fact, you know, as I mentioned, there's this sort of secret seed number that is created when you open your eCash account, and you can escrow that key if you want to with whomever you want to escrow it with, so the person already has the ability to make whatever trade-off they would like, and in fact, the trade-off they've made need not be public, even.
At the end of these scenarios, we'll have a chance for comments from the audience.
Can I raise one question?
Oh, sure.
Dr. Tom, what protects a consumer against an insider at the bank?
comments from the audience.
I mean, that's sort of irrelevant to...
Isn't this an insider, though?
It was written so that it could be an insider. Yes. The problem that I've seen with a lot of these systems with private keys, secret keys, is that the assumption is made that the system is so good that there's no way that it can fail. Well,
there's an interesting property that what I think should properly be called electronic cash has, and it's not widely really understood or perceived at even, and that is technically referred to as multi-party security. And what it means is that each participant in the system is able to protect their own interests fully simply by trusting their own computer system and perhaps how they back up their keys and so forth. So what the implication in this case is that the bank would be, or any insider at the bank would be fully unable to falsely take money from your account, because each withdrawal is, let's say, signed for with a digital signature, and then there are signatures that are provided back to the consumer indicating, you know, what the status of the account is and what's happening. This is all interlocked in such a way that it's highly secure. So, and I should point out that, I mean, this is also orthogonal to the question of whether there's a one-way privacy, as I would prefer to refer to it, or not.
We could imagine a situation in which the interlock suddenly failed. It said you weren't lined up with the bank anymore, and then the bank said that your money wasn't there anymore.
Now, the bank can't take money from your account unless they have signatures from you to justify each point, so that would be sort of the rule. So you can make a multi-party secure system, and just like the Uniform Commercial Code makes certain requirements and so on, if once digital signatures come into widespread use, then this would be sort of, you know, clear and indisputable.
It's important to note, it seems to me, that bank fraud exists now in the current system, and I think what David is saying is that there's no reason why a digital system couldn't in fact be better at precluding fraud against the bank than the existing systems, which are very, very, as Bill Gates says, very dinosaur-like, with all due respect to the American Bankers Association.
Number two.
My name is Special Agent Jenkins.
The truth.
I'm an investigator with the Secret Service working on a counterfeiting case, and it's a tough one. Last year, my office got a priority call from an economist at Stanford. The economist was looking at something called the money supply and the money velocity, and both were increasing a little too fast and just didn't add up. It had taken the economist a few months to figure out what was happening. She finally figured out that some organization was printing its own electronic money, just like the U.S. government does. This counterfeit U.S. digital currency looked just like the real thing, except that it was a fraud. She even found some of it, a digital dollar that was signed and sealed by the U.S. government's secret key, yet had a serial number that had never been issued. Now, I'm not a technologist like you people, but I told the economist that we'd help her out. I asked her what we should do. Should we put together an investigation to look for someone making those credit cards with the chips on them? She said no. The money that was being made was on the internet. It was everywhere and nowhere. And it was encrypted, she said, so we wouldn't even know it when we found it. And it was increasing at the rate of $700,000 to $800,000 a day. Now, $700,000 might not be a lot of money to the guys who oversee Fedwire, but it comes to something like $200 million a year. And since all of this electronic money is being backed by the good faith and value of the U.S. government under the Electronic Banking and Commerce Act of 1998, that $200 million is essentially a tax on U.S. citizens. And it's getting bigger. Last month, the total fraud was up to over $900K, and it's increasing still. We don't know if this knowledge is being sold on the black market or what. But we do know that with more than $1 trillion moving every day on the internet alone, it's going to be nearly impossible to track these counterfeiters down. That's why I've come here for suggestions.
Does anybody have any suggestions?
Change the key.
No. I'll add something. Willie Sutton robbed banks because that's where the money was. There's never been any kind of opportunity for bad guys or good people who would like to make a couple $1 billion and can't resist it than electronic cash.
For suggestions.
Does anybody have any suggestions?
Change the key.
No. I'll add something. Willie Sutton robbed banks because that's where the money was. There's never been any kind of opportunity for bad guys or good people who would like to make a couple $1 billion and can't resist it, than electronic cash might be. It's extraordinarily stupid to build a system that can catastrophically fail or that would have one or two or even a few points of failure or concentrations of opportunity. And it, just as me as a private individual, I have to admit that for $1 billion net, there probably isn't very much that I wouldn't be willing to do, including harming people, in order to walk away. Now, if you combine, you know, some of the, this technology that doesn't flow, move with information.
Black market or what? But we do know that with more than $1 trillion moving every day on the internet alone, it's going to be nearly impossible to track these counterfeiters down. That's why I've come here for suggestions.
Does anybody have any suggestions? Change the key.
No. I'll add something. Willie Sutton robbed banks because that's where the money was. There's never been any kind of opportunity for bad guys or good people who would like to make a couple bills. I'll add something. Willie Sutton robbed banks because that's where the money was. There's never been any kind of opportunity for bad guys or good people who would like to make a couple $1 billion and can't resist it than electronic cash might be. It's extraordinarily stupid to build a system that can catastrophically fail or that would have one or two or even a few points of failure or concentrations of opportunity. And it, just as me as a private individual, I have to admit that for $1 billion net, there probably isn't very much that I wouldn't be willing to do, including harming people in order to walk away. Now, if you combine, you know, some of the, this technology that doesn't flow, move with information, with anonymous repayers and all the really cool, interesting technology, including encryption, you end up with somebody who can hide. Mark Rich isn't really hiding. He's in Zug, Switzerland with a couple $1 billion, but he has the Swiss to protect him. And he had to buy a lot of infrastructure to get the people to be on his side. Robert Vesco spent most of his money in order to buy protection for himself. Someone who steals money this way, no one would know who it is. So depending on whether you're willing to accept an unexplained increase in the general rate of inflation leading to devaluation entirely, or whether you're willing to accept a conditional limitation on the amount of money that can move at any given time from one person to another place, it's a decision that isn't up to us. It may not be up to you. It's probably a decision that resides in Treasury and with FinCEN and the Federal Reserve and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency.
I'd like to point out a couple of things. One is that some 10 years ago or more, I wrote about electronic cash and considered these sort of scenarios. And of course, the standard technique of changing keys comes to mind as is used in most conventional cryptographic systems. And this allows you to move to a new currency and so forth, and there are fallback techniques that allow recovery in case systems keys are compromised and so forth, and there's more in literature as well. But I think this brings up to me the a much more important and general issue, which is that electronic cash is actually far superior to paper money in almost every respect, and it's better in its ability to thwart criminal use of the payment system, as I indicated. It's also potentially far more secure. Counterfeiting is a very substantial problem in the world, particularly United States dollars. The Secret Service will not reveal the extent to which counterfeiting happens and what the tax every American is paying on counterfeiting, but there are currencies that are much harder to duplicate physically are counterfeits in large volume, suggesting that the dollars are counterfeit at an enormous rate. You know, I used to take a somewhat defensive position when trying to advocate electronic cash because I was worried that it might not, you know, it might have some shortcomings. But in fact, it seems that it's much better than paper money, also in the level of security that can be achieved. And by changing keys and so forth, one is able to make it far more secure. Now, if someone were able to, another point you have to consider, break the underlying type of cryptography, let's say the RSA system or whatever flavor of public key you like, then attacking a low, what bankers refer to as a low-value consumer or retail payment system would probably not be the opportunity of choice. Because, I mean, after all, how many, you know, files would you like to download or what have you? What would be far more interesting would be to, you know, like has already happened in the past, create a SWIFT message, send it to, you know, to Switzerland and buy, you know, $25 million worth of uncut diamonds. That's what, if you could break these codes, you'd probably be more interested in attacking the large value transfer systems, which, as mentioned in the scenario, do in fact transfer over $1 trillion a day, which is not real payment. That's currency primarily for financial markets and so on. All that enormous volume of money is secured by the same kind of codes that we use to secure a 5-cent e-cash payment. So, and of course, those codes were also used to protect, you know, command and control systems for nuclear weapons and other kinds of things as well. So, I think that it's kind of silly to think that someone would, who was able to break these codes, would target e-cash.
Well, except that one of the things about sending fake SWIFT messages is that it's really obvious when you remove the money from the system, whereas if I could devise a system that would just let me get $1,000 a day for the rest of my life, you know, I wouldn't tell people that I'd broken the factoring problem.
Let me take a step and look at this from a somewhat different standpoint, because I'm not sure I necessarily agree that this is an answer that gets resolved by the Department of the Treasury or the Federal Reserve Bank. The fact of the matter is no market can operate without confidence on both sides of the transaction. And that suggests to me that if we are going to use the Internet as a major commercial marketplace, and if we are going to move beyond the currency and its relationship with traditional depository institutions and traditional state-based currencies, there is a major, major effort that has to be made by those who are, in fact, developing mechanisms to do that. And we clearly do not have that confidence level at present. I would simply make two observations about it. The conservative nature of the American people when it comes to operating its own markets. We have warehouses in the Department of the Treasury filled with Susan B. Anthony dollar coins because we won't use them because we prefer dollar bills. I think we're the only country in the world that does that. Second, we went through a major, major effort, very expensive confidence-establishing effort when we made this picture of Benjamin Franklin larger on the $100 bill, and because we had major concerns in this country and elsewhere as to whether this was sort of a run on our currency. So when we start talking about taking away the currency itself and going to digital cash, you know, on the net and the like, it seems to me that the only way to establish the advantages of that is, in fact, a close collaborative effort between the people like Dr. Chom and others and the government and the traditional financial institutions. Without that, it seems to me that, you know, that this future we're talking about you know, won't happen.
I have a related question for Mr. Morris, and that is, when I was speaking earlier with Kalika, he told me that these cash cards that Visa and MasterCard are making for the Olympics, there was a problem early on, and they created some evergreen cards. They never decrement. It says $20, but that just means that you can't spend more than 20 at a time. You buy something for 15 bucks, and you've still got $20 on the card. Now, Do you see that as an issue? And is that an issue just for Visa, or is that an issue for the United States?
Well, I'm not quite sure I follow the question. I missed that a little
basically
bit.
Basically, it means that I'm able to take money from Visa, because Visa has guaranteed that when money is taken off of my card, they'll turn it into cash for a merchant. But my card never loses money. So I can just keep spending $20. It's like I can keep writing $20 checks on Visa's corporate checking account forever, or until the card expires.
That sounds like a problem for Visa and the bank that's backing it, not a problem for us.
Let me tell you why that's a problem for everyone. If you were in customer control in the manufacturing center that was creating those cards, and you were supposed to throw out the cards that tested as evergreen, how many of you would actually throw them out? The reason why this stuff is different than everything else is that there are a limited number of endpoints in the traditional payment system. We know where they are. They're all under control of financial institutions that have similar interests in reducing risk. Now, some of them may have less. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International has had less, and many institutions abroad might be more willing to give, you know, ill-gotten gains that they know are ill-gotten over into the hands of people who stole it. But we depend on trusting some of our endpoints more than we trust everyone else. Now, we really don't trust anyone, including our own people, because we can't afford to, and neither can you. But you can rely on the integrity of the infrastructure, which is designed to prevent failure. The last reason why this is an issue is because the U.S. government has never devalued, never demonetized anything. And if there's a failure in security in one class of currency, even if somebody makes a copy a billion times of the same damn note, legally and scientifically, there's no way to distinguish between the validity of the perfect copies, all of the rest of them, and the one that was real. And court, you're going to lose, and whoever created them is going to win. That makes it tough, because there is no such thing today as a perfect copy of a paper bill. There are some very good ones, which is why we switched to the new series bill. But we are trying to manage risk. And the problem is that when you're issuing currency, that you're obligated for anything that might ever be presented to you that looks like a real object. When you're accepting it today, when there's a government as an issuer, the only liability you have is somebody who's accepted it. So there's limited risk. And it's likely that people would probably move, you know, if there were significant risks, to push the government and society to accept the societal risks of system security failure, rather than allowing an individual financial institution that's well capitalized to fail and cause systemic risk throughout the payment system.
Well, I would just like to say I'd love to have one of these cards, but I must say I don't fully agree with that. I think it really is, unless it becomes a real national money card, it really is a problem for Visa, and it's not really much different from the problem they face today from fraudulent use of credit cards. When there's credit card fraud, that's a problem for Visa, and ultimately it is in some sense a problem for all of us because things become more expensive. But it's not a fundamental economic system problem in the way that that tampering with the new $100 bill might be.
Rafael, I'm almost positive that if digital money is successful, the government will want to take it away from the banks and run it for itself. There are just too many advantages for running the currency system that you would allow a private corporation to run it for you.
We lost in 1863, in 1913, 1930, and we expect to lose a few times again. And if you look at the amount of money that the government makes from either seniorage or profits on coinage, you're looking at, depending on the interest rate structure, anywhere from potentially $20 to $40 billion a year. And you don't give that kind of money up when you can build B-2 bombers and put plants and dams in people's districts.
Number three.
My name is Tangent, Dr. Chom. I'd like to thank you for the brilliant idea of conditional payer anonymity because you have made my lifestyle possible. A few years ago, I was cruising around late at night when I saw a man who had a very expensive car in one of those late-night floor shops, you know, the robot shops, where you put in your cash card and you get the flowers. So I followed this guy home, told him that I was with the flower company, and got him to let me into my house. Then I took out a gun and told him to give me his digital wallet or I'd blow his head off. You know what? He gave me his code. Then he told me his PIN. Then I broke my promise and I shot him. As far as I was concerned, this is the perfect crime. Because I had no relationship with this guy, I had his code. And the cash that's inside the card is anonymous. What a deal. I had myself a little conditionally anonymous spending spree. It seemed too good to be true, but it wasn't. Thanks to all of you civil libertarians. At the end of the week, I was out of cash, so I did the same thing again. Now I'm on John Doe number 5. The best thing is, there's no way that you can know where I'm going to strike next. But now I've got a problem, and that's why I've come to talk to you. There are now forces inside the U.S. government who want to make conditional anonymity illegal. They want to have escrowed identity inside the digital cash codes. Can you believe this? I've been watching this very closely, because it's my livelihood that they're talking about. The civil libertarians are chanting, when anonymous digital cash is outlawed, then only outlaws will have anonymous digital cash. But if you outlaw anonymous cash, the government will put me out of business, because my business model depends on getting cash from others. What do you recommend that I do?
Dr. Chong.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, this is more or less similar to some of the previous issues in that it's quite independent from the type of payment system that's used because, in fact, e-cash or any kind of true electronic cash has the one-way privacy feature that I've mentioned, which means that the payer is always able to trace the payments. And so, as I pointed out earlier this afternoon, that secret seed, which could be used to reconstruct this information, can be shared with others. So if someone were to disappear or die or whatever, be robbed, then the trustees of their secrets or their relatives or friends or what have you would be in a position to allow every single payment that was made by the thief to be traced. And as I pointed out earlier, that if there were police or whoever were sufficiently cunning, they could catch this these people and certainly stop them from being able to make further payments if they wish to, just as effectively as with any fully traceable payment system.
I downloaded the eCash software from your website and I didn't see any provisions for this. Is it undocumented?
Yes, in fact, we have the Cyberbucks eCash, which is a global experiment with over 70,000 users. We have the Mark Twain eCash here in the United States, and now in the last few weeks we've launched in Finland with Marita Bank, the largest retail bank in Finland, with 43% of the market, the Finmark denominated eCash, and the client software that's used there in fact has this recoverability feature built into it, although it's not been publicly announced yet, and it's waiting for yet another bank to launch who wants to be able to announce some fancy new feature with their eCash offering.
These features are usually available, but people are dumb, and they don't use them. Any other comments?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether the money is ultimately traceable by somebody else, whether that's used or not. It doesn't matter whether it's escrowed in this way and it reveals the person's identity. By the time it's discovered this guy is dead and the transactions can be traced, this guy has spent all the money and moved on to someone else. But if he's really worried about it, if he really thinks someone might remember him going into the shop at a certain time, well, then he should just switch back to robbing normal cash instead.
Yeah, certainly.
I would agree. I just wanted to point out that, Dr. Chum, you're assuming that everybody's going to use your eCash and do it right. I don't think necessarily you can count on people doing things or governments to always make the right decision or some entrepreneurs to make the right decision and, rather than giving you a royalty, build their own system. And some of the systems that are under consideration that people are offering today, one-person shops, are in fact have inadequate security and inadequate consideration of some of the risks that you have considered.
Yeah. Well, one point I could add is that people, actually users of eCash, would be incented to write down this secret number and store it in a safe place because it's the thing that gives them the same kind of protection that they have with traveler's checks, that if their computer is lost or stolen, they can get all the unspent money back. And so I think that people would tend to write it down, and this would allow for this recoverability as well as tracing in case of criminal theft of the payments media.
How long is the number?
Something like 25 characters. Something you can write down. It has redundancy in it and so forth.
When you first run eCash, it asks you for this 25 character thing you type in, and it says write it down, and you can use it to recover your money if it's taken later.
So. Right. The person says it, put it on a post-it note on your monitor.
Yeah.
Go ahead with your question, please.
Okay, so my name is Ian Goldberg. I'm a researcher in computer security and cryptography at UC Berkeley. Yeah, Dr. Shams' alma mater. And I'm really in favor of eCash. Okay, it's great. I like anonymity. I'm a cypherpunk. But I have to agree with a post made a couple weeks ago by Eric Hughes to Cypherpunks in that it would be irresponsible not to point out that with the current eCash system, you can in fact achieve complete anonymity and not just payee anonymity. And it seems everything that is published just talks about how we can always trace the payer, but in fact it's not true. You can set up a protocol using exactly the same banking software you have now, the banks don't know the difference, that does allow complete anonymity. And why haven't we done
how do you
more?
Do that?
I'm sorry I haven't been following the cypherpunks list as carefully as I should be. I knew there was a meeting where this was discussed. But in any case, about 10 years ago, I published more or less the first article on electronic cash called Privacy Protected Payments. And if you look there in section, I think it's 3.2.4 or something, this so-called mutual anonymity is described. And I'm always, in detailed technical presentations, careful to point out that with the current implementation of eCash, that if someone were to take the trouble to reverse engineer the software and then to get a cooperation, collusion, say, with the recipient, then they would be able to create mutual anonymity. But if you're reading that article, there are solutions to that problem that will prevent someone from re-engineering the software from being able to do that, even with collusion. Furthermore, it's important to keep in mind that the wallet with observer notion, which you may read about in the August 92 Scientific American, which is really what the CAFE project has in fact implemented, is a setting that represents a kind of maturation of the eCash and the chip cards, a sort of convergence of them into an ultimate form, which is extremely effective at addressing that sort of issue without compromising privacy in any sense.
Well, the problem doesn't occur with the hardware implementations because, as you say, it does involve collusion between the payer and the payee and some changes to the client software. But as your company is right now in the process, well, DigiCash USA anyway, is in the process of releasing a API and a library to implement the eCash protocols, it will no longer be necessary to actually use the DigiCash supplied client software, and people will be free to write their own.
Well, let me first thank the cypherpunk community for all their interest in eCash, and and I think that they've been instrumental in getting this API, which is mentioned, to be released and to really opening up eCash, which I think is a very good thing, and was something that's better done sooner than later. However, I think as I'm sure you may very well realize, the current API isn't that low a level that that it would make what you said true, because this stuff is actually done in the core. It's not done above the API. I don't mean to delve into technicalities here, but would still involve reverse engineering, and this would be illegal because of the license agreements and so forth, and not that easy to do.
We do have promises from the people at Mark Twain Bank that this library will be released in source code form.
This is very detailed. Yeah. And I think that we should thank you for pointing this out. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to the fully anonymous version being posted on the internet.
Let me just make one comment about fully anonymous. If you want to call, I call it mutual anonymity when I wrote about it. It's just a fact that such tech protocols can exist and they're known. There wouldn't really have been much use in trying to suppress that knowledge. It's easily accomplished, in fact, and by multiple methods that you may read in the article. But I think the important implication of this to me really is that, and it's related to what Ms. Morris was saying as well, that if we don't get the national currencies in electronic form properly, then the market will sort of move around them and find other currencies, perhaps. And so I think that the approach the U.S. government is taking, at least not regulating the emergence of these technologies, is a really good one, because it will allow the good stuff to grow at internet speed, and this will make an excellent payment system that will not be easily competed with by others. But if these sort of systems were to be inhibited by regulation or what have you, then what would probably happen is offshore or other kinds of systems would emerge. They might very well have mutual anonymity, and this would pose a serious problem to society, I think.
So don't put that program on the internet. Next person.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Bob Hedinga. I'm here again. I have to read my own notes here now. I'm also one of those embarrassing supporters of Dr. Chom. I kind of think of privacy as strong cryptography as like flight. I mean, basically a lot of people died to learn how to fly. And people who died because security was broken over the years, and we can count them as casualties in this sort of war process. But I think that, and it's an inherent good, people just wanted to fly, and people just want privacy. But you get something with flight that's very economically beneficial, and that is the fastest way to get from point A to point B. And with cryptography, it's the fastest way to do business with anybody on the other side of the world, and without a whole lot of intermediaries in the middle. My apologies to the American Banking Association. The other thing is, I noticed that we were presented with another profit chart from the government today, and frankly, the vertical axis on this one actually had numbers in it. I believe those are more and more entities that you have to monitor. If you notice the size of the entities in that exponential curve, where the number of entities you have to watch goes up exponentially. And then the number of transactions goes up, probably not even linearly in relation to that number of entities. The thing you have to remember is that in a geodesic network, one entity cannot handle all the traffic or monitor all the traffic. Okay, the node chokes. And to paraphrase Gilmore, the network sees surveillance as damage and routes around it. And that's really what's going to happen with this. Finally, I think of eCash as kind of a digital bearer bond, and you know, you have a discounted price at issuance, and the underwriter keeps the interest while the money's on the net. Would the panel care to speculate about the future of the capital markets in a world of anonymously traded bearer instruments? And I'll sit down now.
And we'll try to wrap this up in about 8 minutes. Go ahead. Anybody want to speculate on digital bearer bonds?
Depending on how much information flows and whether there are laws to protect people from their people's private property and protect people's rights, there's going to be some losses if, as long as somebody's monitoring and somebody's enforcing the rules, that people shouldn't be ripped off. But it's highly likely, given the lack of effort on the part of some consumers to get enough information to determine whether they're dealing with somebody who deserves to be given their money versus somebody who's intent on taking their money, that there'll be a lot of people who die poor. And at the very least, you're going to see rating agencies. And the question is whether there'll be incentive enough for those rating agencies to do their jobs right over the long term.
I should say that Digital has developed a electronic cash brokering system which will tell you how good each cash they have on their server is. Let's try and move quickly.
Yeah, two quick questions. First for Mr. Morris.
Oh, just one question.
Oh, okay. First for Mr. Morris, then.
Do the second one.
Okay, I'll do the second one. David Chom, how low can you drive the transaction costs in your system or in comparable systems? Nelson was talking about nanobucks being the necessary.
Okay, thanks. I think that cryptography, while here at this conference, is sometimes thought of as an extra feature that we should have because it's good for society and so forth, actually is something that basically can be had for free. And in the new versions of eCash, which are based on stuff which is already in the literature, the actual transaction cost, according to the American Transaction Processing Society benchmarks and all this, is essentially the same as an account-based system. And with client-server computing costs being what they are, the estimates that my little company has developed together with companies like Tandem or whatever are well below a tenth of a cent as a transaction cost, even amortizing the hardware in a single year.
That's wonderful. Next.
Mr. Chom acknowledged that mutually private transactions would be possible by the rise of new protocols. So, Mr. Morris, what methods, if any, do you have to stop the emergence of mutual private exchanges domestically and internationally? And how would you go about exercising such power as you might have?
Well, those are the right questions. I'm not sure we have the right answers. Clearly, there are. The whole thrust, what I tried to do in the very quick run-through, was to focus on the fact that the major thrust of U.S. policy, which has also been paralleled in other major financial center countries in the world, has focused on large transactions. In those areas, we have pushed, and other countries have adopted measures that that do not allow large transactions to occur without some tracks. And that's true both between financial institutions and between financial institutions and their customers. One of the things that you will see, I think, in the CAFE program and the issues of DigiCash and First Virtual and Mondax and others that are testing here are really focusing on the low end of transaction activity, where we have traditionally used cash and where all of the values and advantages of what we have now. So one simple answer would be simply to set some dollar limits.
How can you set dollar limits on banking systems beyond the jurisdiction? How can you set limits on banking electronic cash organizations?
Well, within the CAFE system, you can simply say this card can only hold so much. I mean, technologically, you can do that. You say, well, somebody can violate that. Well, somebody can violate that already. I mean, there's no a regulatory system that's going to avoid greed and crime, whether whatever system you've got. What you try to do is make sure that you have the large amount of your systems in place in such a way that they permit legitimate activity and try to preclude the illegal activity and give some tracks for illegal activity.
We'll make it so you can only put $100 on the card, and when we arrest you, if you have $1,000 on your card, then you're really in trouble. Next.
In Buckminster Fuller's book, Critical Path, he talks about creating this world accounting system where we would use all computer databases and put all of the world's natural resources there. And this would give us a chance to redistribute the wealth. But what I'm hearing you people saying is that the old privileged people with money are going to continue having it, and you're just trying to create a system that's going to keep the old wealth in place. And you're shaking your head, yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because they have the guns, too.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you people that I am asking here for all hackers and people of ethics to go in and get the money and put it in the Earth Bank, because that's the only way we're going to have peace in this world. And when I came here, I thought it was going to be computers, privacy, and freedom for the people. And I haven't found that. All I'm seeing here is the privilege, and you people are the criminals.
That leads me to my next question.
Actually, I'll commit suicide and respond very briefly. There's no reason why, if this technology is deployed well, that individuals aren't going to be able to sell their content and get money that they weren't able to get before because the infrastructure wasn't able to support paying them. In addition, more people are going to be able to move information securely so that there'll be less inappropriate misallocations of wealth. And lastly, as transactions costs come down for financial institutions and everyone who's involved in commerce, prices are naturally going to fall and access is going to move out into the world. Now, we've been moving people for hundreds of years. We moved people into brick and mortar saying, come here, do this way. What the technology will do is give people the power to go out and do their business wherever they want to and do it in a way that they choose so that they're not burdened.
Can I just say one thing briefly? There are possible, the same technology could be used to implement other possible currencies that wouldn't really be a threat to national currency, such as a kid cash that could only be used for kid-friendly sites on the net, or EFF cash, if you like, that would give certain benefits to the organization.
Of course, whenever you have restricted cash, you'll then have markets to interchange between different kinds of cash.
And there's another, there are a lot of theories. There's also things that were formerly called LETs. These are local currency systems. They are popping up here in the United States under different formats. This same technology can be used to implement these sort of things as well, of course.
For instance, the Freemen have their own cash. Go ahead, Peter.
Okay, very quick question. David, you teased us with a suggestion that there have been some rather ominous developments in the last 2 weeks in the international community. Mm. I would like you to elaborate on that a little bit, because it's something I don't think anybody's heard about here yet.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry you didn't want me to elaborate on how we could take these conferences and turn them into more of a real organization that embodies some of the democratic principles and so on that I think a lot of people are interested in. But in any case, to answer your question, apparently there are some meetings that have been occurring to create international policy with respect to cryptography, and there was a lot of positive energy floating around in those meetings until perhaps the last one, where there seems to have been a surprising coup, and the people who put these meetings together in the first place and rallied up all the support and created the whole thing have been kicked out without any explanation, and groups that seem to have a lot of commercial interests and various ties to all kinds of things
seem to have been just sort of left to run it. And now I don't have a great deal of firsthand information, and I find conspiracy theories really fascinating, but I'm not at the moment having time to really get into this sort of thing that deeply. But this is the impression I'm getting. And so it's all well and good to complain about the Clipper Initiative or whatever, but it seems like something much more global, much more serious is happening, and I'm just surprised that there wasn't much awareness of it here at this meeting. And so I think I felt that it was incumbent upon me to at least allude to it, and those people who would be concerned about something like this might want to look into the details.
People who are concerned about... I'm sorry? Hmm?
Mr. Morris, comment on that general statement?
I don't know what he's talking about.
I think Dr. Chama is referring to some shakeups in international meetings regarding the restriction of cryptography. And there are at least three people at this conference I've spoken with, and they could all come up front afterwards during the break and talk to Dr. Chama and anybody else who's interested. So thank you very much. And I learned a lot.